Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment in China. He should be back for our next program. On our last program, I mentioned our best-selling science video, The Global Flood in the Hydroplate Theory, and that it has a section on it on the origin of Earth's radioactivity produced by Brian Nichol. He's a mechanical engineer and an advocate of Dr. Walt Brown's hydroplate theory on the mechanism of the global flood. Well, Brian came on the program and we began to discuss his video series, his tutorials on the hydroplate theory. And so to continue that today, what an honor to have Brian Nichol back on. Brian, welcome back to Real Science Radio.
Thanks again, Bob.
Well, you're very welcome. If possible, maybe you and I could give a real brief summary of what we covered on part one, and that was we looked at the evolutionary claim of how the Earth originated, and that's with asteroids, meteoroids, rocks, planetesimals smashing together, and that causes a tremendous amount of heat. And so the Earth, over millions of years, as it's forming, is a molten mass of melted rock, and it's molten for hundreds of millions of years, and then eventually it starts to cool, and the rest is allegedly history. But, Brian, we looked at some problems with that model. Could you just mention a couple of them?
Yes. Well, in that molten state, materials that are of a given density, denser materials are going to gravitationally settle down toward the core, and lighter materials will tend to escape out to the surface, especially materials like water, which at the molten state temperatures of rock would easily be a gas. And so we would expect water to be all starting out on the surface in that scenario.
And not only and we would expect, that's the general evolutionary expectation.
Well, yeah, I mean, physics demands it. And so the surprise that we discussed last time was that we, in spite of that, find water much deeper than it should be if the evolutionary scenario is correct.
And the water, whether it's in the deepest drill holes on Earth, like in Germany, 5.5 miles, and in Russia, 7.5 miles, or this amazing study in New Zealand, the seismic study, where they set off explosives to get a very accurate picture of what's under the crust there. And they found that, and they were very puzzled, that almost 50 miles down, they found a 6-mile-thick channel containing melted rock and or water, and that was published last year in the journal Nature. And so we talked about how so many of the scientific observations, the findings of the secular scientific community, are affirming, they're consistent with the biblical account of creation on day one, and the global flood, and of course, then Dr. Walt Brown's hydroplate theory. So where we left off was I was hoping to discuss with you some of the Bible verses you mentioned in part one, because I love your videos because they take science and they take the scriptures and they show that they're not in opposition, but they affirm one another.
Correct. And one of the tenets that Walt makes, one of his assumptions, is that the Earth began with a granite shell that was completely encircling the Earth, and that down below, far down below, there was deep water. And in the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, and later on in chapter 7, it refers to this as the great deep. In Genesis chapter 1, the deep is described as being divided, and Walt would maintain that half that water, it began 60 miles below this granite shell that was the part of the original creation. And the Bible, in many other places, refers to this deep. In Psalm 33:7, it says that God lays up the deep in storehouses. Mm. So it's inside of something. In Psalms 24:1-2, a phrase in there says that he founded it, the earth, upon the seas and upon the waters. And then Psalm 136:6, it says that God spread out the earth above the waters. And so it paints a picture that the earth was at one time above some body of water.
Well, above some body of water, right, when Genesis 1 says that God made the rakia, and the Hebrew verb raka is to spread out something, like when you gold plate or silver plate something, the Bible describes that, and it says that they raka, they gold plated these implements in the temple. And so when the scriptures say that God raka the earth, he made a rakia, the shell, the crust of the earth, it says that he raka the earth above the waters. And when you use the word assumption, and Walt uses that word, that the hydroplate has one primary assumption, that when God created the earth, that the water for the flood was under the crust. So from Walt's perspective, that's an assumption. But in our video, Real Science Radio presents the global flood in the hydroplate theory, we point out all the biblical material saying where God tells us that that's what he did. We say that this assumption is actually a given because God says it. It's a given. So some people disagree with that, of course, especially if somebody holds to the vapor canopy theory or some other idea that meteorites collided with the earth, the impact model, that caused the global flood. But if you take the Bible's description that the flood was caused by the breaking up of the fountains of the great deep, then this is a given that God stored the waters for judgment. They were held in reserve until the flood below the crust of the earth.
Right. And in Genesis chapter 7, verse 11, it says that on the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open. And so when you take all these verses together and you ask yourself, well, what is it really saying here? Hydroplate theory, I think, presents the clearest picture, a very literal picture of exactly what the Bible describes. And that's one thing that I think perhaps because Walt and I are engineers, so we always are interested in stating our beginning assumptions. But yeah, our first assumption is that the Bible is correct and inerrant, and that it is God's word to us, and that when it states something, you don't have to manipulate the words to make it fit some preconceived theory. Best to just let the context speak for itself. Mm. And I think that's what Walt has done here, and I think his theory lines up very well with what Scripture said.
Well, sure. In Psalm 136:6 that you quote, the Bible speaks of God who laid out the earth above the waters. And that is, again, raka. He made the rakia, which is the crust of the earth. You know, we have an article on this at rsr.org/firmament, the firmament of the earth, what God made on day two. And Brian, I don't know if you've looked at it, but the Babylonian creation epic, you know, we know about the Epic of Gilgamesh. That's this early pagan recollection of the global flood. And it has amazing parallels to the Genesis account. In Genesis, we have the God-inspired, accurate account of the flood. And all over the world, we have 200 different ancient cultural recollections of the global flood. It's astounding how the world has a collective memory. Well, the Babylonians, they also had a creation epic, the Enuma Elish, and it's on six tablets. And the sixth tablet is the creation of man. And in this creation epic, on day one, basically they're describing day two of Genesis. And this is at the very beginning of their first tablet. And it says that the waters were commingling as a single body when no marshland had yet appeared, like no dry land. And then it says something that just blows my mind. It says, when on high, the heaven had not been named. You get that? The name of heaven, it hadn't been called heaven yet. When on high, the heaven had not been named, firm ground below had not been called by that name. So it says, the ground on the earth, the firm ground, had not been called by the same name that heaven above had been called. So in Genesis, God calls the earth heaven because this is part of his heaven on earth. Adam and Eve, they didn't have to die to go to heaven. They were in heaven. They were in God's kingdom of heaven on earth. And so that throws off so many people when they see God made the firmament. Yeah, the firmament, there's waters below the crust, waters above the crust. But then in verse 8, God called the firmament heaven. They put on the brakes and they say, oop, we must have been wrong. The firmament is not terra firma. It's not the crust. It must be the sky.
Right. I've heard when you take a word and you apply a certain meaning to that word all the time, I've heard it rephrased as an illegitimate totality transfer. In other words, you always associate your meaning with that word, and you do that to the exclusion of other possible meanings. And the word heaven can mean paradise. And so it wouldn't be unforeseen that God, when in the midst of his creation of creating things very good, that he would refer to what he had just created as the future paradise that he was creating.
Well, sure. Even today, even with that illegitimate transfer, they still speak of the atmosphere of the earth as heaven, and then outer space, heaven, and then the throne room of God, heaven. So there's three heavens even today, which are accurate, but the atmosphere is just one molecule above the surface of the earth. It's just one molecule above. So the only thing that's changed in the meaning of the word is the width of one molecule, because when God made the earth, it was part of his kingdom of heaven. It was the kingdom of heaven on earth. So at any rate, I think that gets us back to your video and these verses, which then you go into another topic. Not only is there a subterranean water chamber 60 miles below the surface, but then the Bible talks about the earth's pillars. And so could you describe that for a moment in the hydroplate theory?
Yeah, Walt has proposed that the pillars that are mentioned in the Bible mentions that God laid the earth, set the earth on pillars, that this would be a natural result of the granite sagging in places and contacting the solid mantle, and the deep still being trapped below would have been pressurized, and most of the weight of the granite was actually being supported by the pressurized water, but there were points where the granite sagged down and touched the mantle in multiple points around the earth in the initial created condition.
So that on day two, God makes the rakia, the terra firma, the crust of the earth, and it's to divide the waters below from the waters above. So below this rakia, the crust of the earth, there's about a mile deep of water in the subterranean chamber. And it's interesting that day two is the only day that God does not say that it was good. It's the only day he doesn't. He holds off until day three, because then on day three, the dry land appears, similar to in this Babylonian Enuma Elish. So then the dry land appeared. So what Walt is saying, if you take all this very literally and apply physics to it, when God creates the shell, the 60-mile-thick shell of granite around the earth with a mile deep of water below it, that granite, because of different densities, will begin to sag in certain areas, and it will sag and literally touch the bottom of the chamber. So in hundreds of places around the earth, that granite shell is sagging down and sitting on the bottom of the chamber. Each of those places forms what the Bible calls a pillar that God rested the earth. In fact, it says, you quote Psalm 75:3, God firmly set the earth's pillars. He firmly set the earth upon its pillars.
Right. Right. And sometimes I explain the scenario that I imagine happened as if you flooded your basement with a 1-inch layer of water, and then you laid a sheet of plastic over the top of that, a thin sheet of plastic over the top of that 1-inch thick layer of water, you wouldn't expect that plastic to remain perfectly level 1 inch above your concrete floor for very long, especially if you were to then dump a gallon bucket of more water on top of that or to add another inch. That plastic would become deformed, just responding to imbalances. And so that's kind of the scenario that I kind of envision. Mm.
And so then on the surface of the earth, God's heaven on earth, the paradise that he was preparing for Adam and Eve, there would be places where the dry land appeared, and there would be shallow seas that would form. So the water would begin to collect in shallow seas spread out around the globe.
Exactly. As pillars dropped down, the surrounding material would tend to rise up, and as the surface above the pillar would fill with the waters that were above, then basically there'd be portions of granite adjacent to that that would rise up out of the waters above. Mm-hmm. And just like God says, dry land appeared in Genesis 1, 9, and 10.
So in your video, part one, the overview of the hydroplate theory, you begin with a series of questions. And you acknowledge that those who doubt the flood, that they have questions that even Christians who believe in the flood often cannot answer. And so maybe we could look at some of those questions. One of your first questions is, how did water cover Mount Everest? Mount Everest is, what, 29,029 feet above sea level. So how could water cover all the mountains of the earth?
Well, the problem with that statement, that question, is that it has a hidden assumption that Mount Everest existed at the time of the flood, and that is not at all what Walt Brown's hydroplate theory proposes. It would imagine an earth where mountains were perhaps 9,000 feet tall, and if, for instance, you took all the water in today's oceans, and you set that aside, and then you bulldozed all the continents and all the mountains flat,
yeah,
and then you put the water back on the earth so that the ground was just the perfect sphere and no topography at all, that ocean water would be 9,000 feet all around the globe.
Wow.
And so mountains as high as 9,000 feet could have existed before the flood.
So in other words, okay, I'll just restate what you just said, that on the surface of the earth today, if the earth was a smooth sphere, sort of like a billiard ball, then the water, it would be one huge global ocean, and it would be 9,000 feet deep.
Yep.
Wow, that's deep. So that if there were 9,000 foot tall mountains before the flood, then they would have been covered. Even the mountain peaks, as the Bible describes. And by the way, the evolutionists today, and I use that term generally for the secular origins community, they acknowledge that the continents are eroding. They're eroding away. And there are different claims, and if you take the most reasonable assumptions, all the continents would erode to sea level within 10 million years. 10 million. But if you take the most conservative assumptions, then it would take 20 million years. But they have so many problems because they have these fossils that they claim are 75 million years old, 150 million years old, 350 million years old, and they've got all the strata. And it's like in the most macroscopic view of their theories, they contradict themselves at every turn. But so Mount Everest, even if the atheists were right, Mount Everest couldn't be there right now. It would have eroded away. And they say, well, it replenishes itself, right? The mountains, you got seafloor spreading, plate tectonics, and the mountains are constantly pushed up. Yeah, but they're evolutionary index fossils, they don't replenish themselves. So if something was 75 million years ago and it left some dinosaur track, well, then how does that survive after the entire continent should have been eroded away, you know, 10 times over?
Right. Many times it's insidious how much special pleading occurs when the evolutionary real demand for more time just to make it even conceivably possible violates so many other clocks that we see on Earth that don't line up with a billion-year-old age.
Another question you ask, so I'd like to go through these questions that flood doubters would ask, and often they don't hear answers to their questions. Another is, 40 days of constant rain? Come on, that's not possible. Evaporation doesn't work that fast. You can't have 40 days of nonstop torrential rain.
Right, and global torrential rain. The issue with that is that rain in order to form, as far as clouds are concerned, requires condensation nuclei, little dust particles, to even form. And so raindrops can't even form without these dust particles. So number one, where did all these dust particles come from? And then number two, rain in the act of falling is knocking dust out of the air and defeats itself, and that's why rain doesn't last for long, long periods of time. You might get rain for maybe 2 weeks at maximum in a rainforest.
Yeah, right.
But you would not expect 40 constant days of global rain. We have to explain where that rain came from. Another assumption in that question is, we're assuming that the rain came from clouds in the traditional understanding of the hydrodynamic cycle. But that, again, is an assumption. And I think Walt does a very great job of showing how there is a much better mechanism to describe all that rain.
And that mechanism, which was affirmed also by Dr. Henry Morris, the father of the modern creation movement, is the fountains of the great deep bursting forth so that the water came from under the crust of the earth, and it came up with such tremendous force that it went up into the atmosphere and fell down. Much of it fell down back on the surface of the earth. Some of it reached escape velocity and left the earth and ended up pummeling, beating the tar out of the moon, especially the near side of the moon, and sending debris out into the solar system, so that indeed the whole creation groans in the travail of the rebellion that was brought on the earth by Adam.
And yeah, it's
Eve.
Funny you mentioned the moon being pummeled. Now, whenever I look at the moon, I think actually of the flood. And one video that I'm actually currently working on right now is, it will include a segment that explains just how material launched from the fountains of the great deep on earth pummeled the moon. And what we see today is likely scars and evidence of impacts from materials launched from Earth.
Well, Brian, you've heard the atheists say that creationists don't publish in science journals. Well, a young Earth creationist recently published an astronomy paper in one of the world's most highly respected astronomy journals, the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society in England. And it's about the TNOs, the trans-Neptunian objects, and that they had to have a recent origin and from the inner solar system. Recent origin and from the inner solar system. This guy's a professor of astronomy at a very prestigious institution. And he also happens to be a supporter of the hydroplate theory. And he published a paper on Dr. Walt Brown's website. And he has the math. And he shows that if about 1.5% of the debris that was shot out of the earth by the fountains of the great deep, if 1.5% of that hit the moon, that would have given the moon in its current orbit and with all the pockmarks it has, that would explain what happened to the moon. Just 1.5% of all that debris.
Yeah, in Genesis chapter 7, even, there is some evidence that, and of course we know this from many ancient cultures around the world, used a 360-day calendar and 30-day lunar months. And I believe the paper you're talking about, the author of that, had gone off of the premise that perhaps that really was the length of the year, perhaps that really was the length of each month, was exactly 30 days.
Yeah.
And if the moon had a circular orbit and then gained that much mass during the flood, he shows in his calculations that that would throw the orbital elements of the moon off, and basically it would give us the observations that we have today of the moon's orbit, its period, and also its eccentricity, or the ovalness of its orbit.
Yes, and right now I'm Googling 360-day year, because that's one of our favorite topics here at Real Science Radio. And out of about 80,000 results that Google thinks are relevant, they have as number three, so number three out of 80,000, our own website, Real Science Radio's 360dayyear.com, where we list all the ancient authorities and the ancient historical accounts of a 360-day year used all over the world, from the Mayans to the Egyptians to the Aztecs in India and the Sumerians, and it just goes on and on. The Chinese and, of course, the Bible indicates a 360-day year. So what changed the year from 360 days, which was perfect, to our broken 365 and a quarter days? It was the global flood, and the hydroplate theory explains the mechanism, the melting of the outer core of the Earth, and that shrunk the Earth, and because of the conservation of angular momentum, it began to rotate on its axis a little quicker, another 5 days per year. So that's in a nutshell.
That's in a nutshell, and I guess you can watch parts 1 through 6 of my videos, and you'll get a visual accounting of what you just described.
And I can't wait, Brian, to see your video on the moon. Wow, that's going to be fascinating. We're about out of time. Real quick, two last questions. Where did the water come from, and where did all the water go? We did a program about, well, it was last summer, Fred Williams and I, where the young Earth creation movement, the part of the movement that doesn't agree with Walt Brown, that the fountains of the great deep came from below the crust, all that, and that's Ken Ham, and that's creation.com, and all the big creation groups, they don't know where the water came from. They cannot answer this question. We did a show on this where I talked to some of the scientists, the leading scientists of catastrophic plate tectonics and the vapor canopy theory and the impact model. They cannot explain where the water came from for the global flood, but how about the hydroplate theory?
Well, I think in our last episode and also during our time talking today, we see where it came from, and we can go stand at a beach anywhere on any continent and look out and see where the water went, and it's in the ocean basins today. That volume of water could cover the Earth to a depth of 9,000 feet if the topography was different, if we didn't have continents.
Yes.
So if half of the ocean water that we see today in our oceans was above a supercontinent that only had 9,000-foot mountains, and then the other half of that was trapped below in the Great Deep, and then the flood, as described in the Bible, played out, then you would easily have covered for a time, for the year during the flood that's described in Genesis 7 and 8, you would have a condition where you had a ton of water, double the water above the topography originally was shaped as, and so you would have had deep water all around the globe for a good deal of time.
And so then, as the Bible describes, the mountains are raised up in a day, and maybe that's a topic for a future program, or especially for people to view your series, your 6-part series on the hydroplate theory. But then the mountains were raised up, and the continents came up out of the waters, and then the flood waters drained off the continents and into the ocean basins.
Right. And you do a lot better, Bob, at describing things in a nutshell. My best stab at describing this entire process in a nutshell is about 2.5 hours of video presentation.
Well, it's just tremendous. I'll tell you what, Brian, it's helped me a lot understanding these. I've been studying Walt's model not as long as you have, but maybe for 10 years now. Walt Brown is amazingly personable, humble. He's had us to his home repeatedly. Our children have gone swimming in his backyard pool. His wife, Peggy, in that family, the hero is Peggy Brown. I'll tell you that. She was a rescuer saving babies at abortion clinics. She got arrested in the nonviolent, peaceful Operation Rescue days. And so Walt and Peggy Brown, they're heroes in our book, and we just love them dearly. And I know that you've developed a friendship with Walt. That's pretty awesome. It's like having been friends with Isaac Newton or Johann Kepler. It's like that. And you have that privilege, Brian Nickel, to be a friend of Walt Brown. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I've really been surprised at his openness when I first contacted him and his wanting to get together and talk about some of these things and some of his new theories that he's been mulling over in his mind for a decade sometimes. And it's really been quite an experience to just to get to know him and then to interact with him on, you know, probably at least a monthly basis.
Mm. So, all right, Brian, thank you. That's your overview of the Hydroplate Theory, part one, your first video. And what a joy to speak with you. Again, we will link to that from our website at rsr.org. And we're going to send people over to your channel, Brian, and encourage folks to watch these videos and to share them, to post them on Facebook, to put links out there on their own websites to get the word out.
All right, Bob. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. That's Brian Nickel, mechanical engineer and an advocate of Walt Brown's Hydroplate Theory. What a thrill to talk with Brian. Again, his video on the origin of Earth's radioactivity is included in our video, The Global Flood and the Hydroplate Theory. If you haven't seen that video, please, we encourage you. We got a 30-day money-back guarantee on all our materials. So if you don't like it, of course, we'd be thrilled to refund your money. We would be. So we could show everyone we stand by our guarantee. But hardly ever does someone ask for their money back. I think less than five times in 25 years. So that's less than once per 5 years. But what a fun video. And in our video, you'll see Brian's origin of radioactivity. And you'll also help Real Science Radio stay on the air. If you go to our website and click on our store, you could browse our science department. We only have the best of the best science materials there. The best of the best. There are thousands of videos, 1,000 books on creation. But what you find on our channel is from Fred and I, 30 years each of studying, watching, reading, and we have compiled for you just a handful of the very best resources. We think you'll love them and you'll help us stay on the air. And we're heading toward our 25th anniversary, where in Denver on Friday night, June 3rd, if you're in town, we have a Founders Club dinner at Shanahan Steakhouse. It's expensive, but the goal is to help us stay on the air for another 25 years if need be. If the Lord tarries, it's $1,000 a plate. There's about 25 people registered right now, signed up to attend. So it'll be a small gathering, and it's a time to hang out together and talk and get to know each other. So I hope you can make it. If not, the next day, Saturday, June 4th, is a picnic celebration of our 25-year anniversary at Denver Bible Church, which is in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, a picnic. And then Sunday morning, Sunday school and the worship service at Denver Bible Church. It'll be a fabulous weekend. If you can make it, that would be great. If you buy our products or donate, you help us stay on the air for another year, reaching more and more people. So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. By the handiwork of God, tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real, that's what I'm talking about.